First will be Dan O'Brien, an Executive Vice President at Compass Lexicon. Dan was Deputy Director of the FTC's Bureau of Economics, and prior to that was Chief of the Economic Regulatory Section at the DOJ Antitrust Division. Dan co-authored some of the main theoretical work underlying the analysis of competitive impacts of cross-ownership and common ownership in competing firms. Dan?
Thank you, Bill. I'm pleased to be here today with such a distinguished group to discuss common ownership, which I think is a very important topic for the FTC and other competition authorities around the world. Last week, my good friend Martin Schmaltz tweeted that it was bad form for the FTC to include me on the program without my disclosing past consulting work that I've done relating to common ownership. So Martin, I think you know a better than that. I've been an academic, I've been a government policy wonk, and I've been a consultant. And in each of those positions, I've been fortunate enough to publish articles in the top peer-reviewed journals in my field. And frankly, I find it a little bit insulting that you would insinuate in public through a tweet that my remarks today are somehow tainted by some consulting work that I did for the industry. I think you'll find that my analysis today is just that, it's analysis. But since you raised the question, I'm not being compensated for my participation or my remarks today, and I've not been paid by a third party for work on common ownership for over a year. That said, I agree with you, Martin, that there is value in knowing what drives research forward, and with that in mind, I'm going to tee up my discussion today in a way that fully discloses my research and my consulting work on common ownership. Okay, so in the mid-90s, I co-authored a paper titled The Competitive Effects of Partial Ownership, Financial Interest and Corporate Control. At the time, I was consulting with cable TV companies about transactions that involved changes in partial ownership interests, and we needed a way to analyze the problem. So the result was this academic paper, which probably would not have been written without the motivating consulting work. And I've published a number of papers motivated by consulting work in the same way. The paper develops a very general theory that explains how partial common ownership can have anti-competitive effects. And it shows how one can quantify those effects. 18 years later, Martin and co-authors published a very important paper examining common ownership in the airline industry that by all appearances draws heavily on the theoretical framework that I helped develop in conjunction with my colleagues at the time, Steve Salop. Our framework was really the only rigorous theory of how common ownership could harm competition at the time. And in fact, newer theories that are coming out tend to build on the earlier framework. So in particular, Azar, Schmaltz, and Teku, they drew on our paper for the key explanatory variable in their analysis, the modified Herfindahl-Hirschman index, or MHHI. I became aware of Azar, Schmaltz, and Teku's paper in 2015 while I was at the FTC. It's always gratifying when your own research is used by others. But I had several concerns about how they applied the theory of partial ownership to the common ownership question. I published a critical review in the ABA's Transportation, Energy, and Antitrust newsletter that same year. And in my review, which was not funded by any third party, I touched on many of the issues that I'll discuss in a few moments. That same year, while at the FTC, I began working on a technical paper that dissects some well-known and some less well-known problems with price concentration regressions, which was the methodology used in Azar, Schmaltz, and Teku. That paper also received no third-party funding, by the way. Then in 2017, I wrote a note for the OECD on common ownership, raising many of the same issues. That paper also received no funding. Finally, also in 2017, I co-authored two papers, one that's now published, critical of the application of the theory that I helped develop to the issue of common ownership by institutional investors. Okay, those papers did receive funding from ICI, as is fully disclosed on those papers. They make the same points, essentially, that I am going to make today and that I had made previously before I even knew who ICI was. So that brings us today, and as I said earlier, I'm here really on my own dime, but it seems more like a quarter because New York is very expensive. Okay, so this short history of my involvement in research and consulting on common ownership kind of tees up my topic for the session, which is the application of the theory of partial ownership to questions about common ownership by institutional investors. This is a narrow focus, but I think it's an important one because I think it's important for the theory that motivates empirical analysis to be appropriate to the question at hand. Okay, I think it's fair to say that we're here today in large part because of the empirical findings in Martin's important papers. I find that when the level of policy interest in new research reaches a certain decibel level, it often makes sense to pause, take a 40,000-foot view of the landscape, and make a reasoned assessment, and that's what I hope to do in the next 15 minutes. First, what is partial ownership, and why do we need a theory about it? So most economic theory and most applications of economics to policy assume that the firm is a monolithic decision maker whose objective is to maximize profits. The economics we see in textbooks is built on this assumption. Of course, this assumption is an abstraction. With the exception of a sole proprietorship, firms typically have more than one owner, and each owner partially owns the firm. If the owners agree that the firm's objective should be to maximize the profits of the firm, then the assumption that the firm behaves as a monolith is fine. But if different owners want the firm to pursue different objectives for whatever reason, how will the firm behave? Okay. The theory of partial ownership that Steve and I worked out was developed to answer this question. The theory provides a way to model how firms behave when a firm's owners have divergent interests. The theory then analyzes how markets function when firms pursue this objective, which could be quite different from the standard objective of maximizing own firm profits. Okay, so I've been using the term partial ownership. Where does common ownership fit in? So common ownership occurs when one or more owners of a company also owns one or more other companies. The FTC discussed a more nuanced definition earlier today, but I'm sticking with the analytical definition that works for economists when we think about this, okay? The companies are said to be commonly owned in this case because they have some owners in common. A peer horizontal merger, for example, is a special case of common ownership, technically, where the merging firms become commonly owned. That may be inconsistent with discussions of common ownership in policy and legal discussions, but analytically, that's true. Interesting questions arise, though, when common ownership also involves partial ownership. When different partial owners have different common ownership interests in firms whose profits are interrelated in some way, different owners are apt to have divergent interests. For example, a non-common owner that holds shares in Company A wants Company A managers to pursue strategies that maximize the profits of Company A. But a common owner that owns shares of Company A and Company B wants the manager of Company A to compete less aggressively to increase its returns from its partial ownership of Company B. This shows how different degrees of partial common ownership by different owners create divergent interests among the owners. The theory of partial ownership was built to address this situation, as I said. So how does the theory do this? What does the theory assume about what a firm's managers do when owners have divergent interests? Well, the theory assumes, naturally enough, that managers pursue strategies that are in the interests of the firm's owners. In particular, and this is the key assumption of the theory on which the empirical work was based, each manager maximizes a weighted average of the returns to the firm's owners from their shareholdings in the relevant common ownership group. That's a lot, okay? There's a lot in that statement, so I want to take it apart because the usefulness of the theory for understanding specific cases of common ownership depends on the accuracy of the assumptions that relate to the three elements that I underlined: the control weights, returns as an objective, and the relevant common ownership group. Before carving into these assumptions, I want to just stop and say, you know, what about this theory? Is this theory goofy, or do we think it's okay? So what are the scholar views of the theory? I think generally positive, and I say that based on two observations. First, much of the literature on the subject uses the theory either as a starting point for extending it or to motivate empirical work. And second, my experience on the kind of presentation trail of work related to common ownership is that folks don't find the theory itself objectionable. Okay, but that said, like any theory, it comes with warning labels, and they relate to the three elements that I had underlined on the preceding slide, which I now want to go through. So the first warning is that serious side effects may occur with improper control weights, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. A second warning is that you should consult your doctor before using this model if your relevant common ownership group includes antitrust markets beyond the market at issue. And a third warning label is consult your doctor before using this model if owners' objectives differ from investment returns. Those are the three warning labels I want to discuss in the rest of my talk. These three warning labels raise troubling issues for using the theory of partial ownership to assess the competitive effects of common ownership by institutional investors. Okay, so the first warning label relates to control weights. Remember that the theory assumes that managers care about the returns to their owners, but because the owners typically have different ownership interests, the manager has to decide how much weight to give each owner in deciding what to do. Okay? The weight given to a particular owner is the owner's control weight. In the theory, this is just a number between 0 and 1, such that the control weights sum to 1 for a given firm. The manager's maximizing a weighted average of the interests of the owners. In practice, the value of these weights that lie between 0 and 1 is really critical. If common owners' control weights are 0, for example, common ownership has no effect. And if the control weights are positive, it can have anti-competitive effects, the size of which depends in a somewhat complex way on financial interests and control weights. Here's a bit of economic humility. Economists do not have robust, tested theories about how ownership shares translate into control weights. Jose Azar, one of the co-authors of the airline paper that brought us here today, I think it's fair to say, has a nice paper from his dissertation that provides one motivation of what Salop and I called proportional control, which occurs when managers give their owners weights equal to their ownership shares. I think Jose's paper is interesting. It was alluded to in an earlier discussion today, and I recommend reading it, but it's one motivation for proportional control. It's not especially compelling for many reasons. It's a long discussion, and it's not been tested. Other approaches to control use cooperative voting models, such as the Bonzoff Power Index, Shapley's voting model, and so on. These approaches are also not well tested. So the question is, what are the appropriate control weights? The assumptions about control in the empirical literature also raise additional puzzles. Okay, suppose a company is owned by a set of common owners and a set of non-common owners that have very small shares. The non-common owners have very small shares. So the non-common ownership is diffuse. Under proportional control, okay, which is the assumption in Azar, Schmaltz, and Teku used to create the modified Herfindahl-Hirschman index, they also considered Bonzoff control. If the number of non-common owners is large, those owners have essentially no say, okay, in the direction of the firm. Their control weights are near zero. On the other hand, a common owner that holds even 1% of the firm has almost complete control over the firm. Okay. So is this assumption reasonable? That's a prediction of the theory, that if ownership by non-common owners is diffuse, they have no control. Is this assumption reasonable? Well, experts in corporate finance, or corporate law, rather, they say no. In the U.S., a firm's directors have a fiduciary obligation to the firm and to the owners as to their interest in the firm. In other words, the law technically obligates directors to pursue objectives that are in the best interest of the firm, which means they should not place weight in their objective functions on the returns of shareholders from their ownership in rival firms. Now, I won't stand here and say that that common owners can never influence management to pursue strategies contrary to non-common owners' interests, but I'll note that compensation of managers in most major U.S. corporations is based on a firm's stock, in part, and this gives the manager at least a short-run incentive to price in a way that maximizes the profits of the firm, consistent with fiduciary obligation and inconsistent with anti-competitive effects from common ownership. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead to warning label 2. This relates to what I've called the relevant common ownership group. This group consists of firms that are commonly owned and whose profits are interrelated. For example, airlines that are commonly owned and compete with each other are in the same relevant common ownership group. In addition, if the airline's suppliers and customers are also owned by the same common owners, they should also be included in the relevant common ownership group. Azar, Schmaltz, and Teku's paper assumes that the relevant common ownership group consists of the airlines and only the airlines. However, the same institutional investors that own the airlines also own airline suppliers and customers. Okay, why is this important? Well, under AST's assumption, institutional investors ignore the impact of airline prices on airline suppliers and business travels. Yet an increase in airfares has a negative effect on both groups. Both impacts give common owners incentives to lower price rather than raise it. Similarly, in the European Commission's use of the MHHI to analyze the Dow-DuPont merger, they assume that institutional investors would ignore the impact of agrochemical companies' strategies on their suppliers and buyers, which institutional investors also partially own. These impacts can give common owners incentives to reduce price rather than raise it. Okay, so in the interest of time, I'm going to go on to warning label 3, which is that owners' objectives differ, institutional investors' objectives differ significantly from the objectives of owners that are not institutions. Okay. Institutional investors make money by attracting retail investors. Is this accomplished by instructing Company A to pull its competitive punches against Company B, to increase the value of the institution's shareholdings in Company B? That is, should Vanguard instruct United Airlines to raise price to increase the value of its position in American Airlines? What if Fidelity owns a larger share of American than Vanguard? Then Vanguard's strategy would increase the value of Fidelity's portfolio more than the value of its own portfolio. Is this something Vanguard wants to do? The point is that institutional investors that purchase shares for retail investors have vastly different incentives than investors that purchase shares for themselves. The theory of partial ownership was built to capture the incentives of investors that purchase their own shares. It was not built to capture the incentives of institutional investors. And in fact, I'm not sure we have a really good idea at this point of what those incentives are. We really need a theory of how institutional investors compete with each other and the implications of this competition for how they behave to influence managers before we can apply the theory to the question of common ownership by institutional investors. So I'm going to conclude by summarizing circumstances where I think the theory of partial ownership is properly and improperly applied. The theory can be quite useful when three conditions are satisfied. Control weights are reasonably clear or can be bounded. The relevant common ownership group is properly defined. and owners have the objective of maximizing their returns across the relevant common ownership group. These conditions often hold in transactions that involve changes in partial ownership among a few large companies or investors, but for common ownership by institutional investors, control weights are not clear, research has not properly identified relevant common ownership groups, and there's a mismatch between the objectives of asset managers and the objectives assumed by the theory. Thank you very much.